Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the eighth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is Constitutional Crisis, the Penalties for Free Speech. We'll talk about free speech, chilled speech, self-censorship, historically in the U.S. and currently. We've been producing this radio show for over 20 years, and this is the first time that invited guests have been afraid to come on the radio and criticize the federal government. This is not normal. This will be our sixth program in the series on a constitutional crisis. This show was pre-recorded on September 12th. We're not taking listener calls. Send your comments to WERU, news@weru.org, and please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. My name is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum today. We were fortunate to find two esteemed guests who were not afraid to come on the show today. So let me introduce them. Molly Curran-Rolls is the Executive Director at ACLU Maine. Welcome, Molly.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be here.
And Timothy Zick is the Robert and Elizabeth Scott Research Professor and the John Marshall Professor of Government and Citizenship at William & Mary Law School. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Tim, I'll ask you first. Let's just start with some basics. We could spend the whole hour on this, but what is the First Amendment and what did the framers intend?
Well, the First Amendment, which was actually, I think, third on the list originally, but a couple of amendments dropped out, protects a number of different liberties, or at least it's designed to protect a number of different liberties. Freedom of speech, obviously, but also freedom of the press, the right to peaceably assemble, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, and there are two religion clauses that protect religious freedom. So it's actually designed to do quite a lot. It appears from its text. The petition, assembly, speech, and to some extent press provisions in the First Amendment have over time by the Supreme Court sort of been lumped together as a free expression guarantee. So we don't have sort of separate branches in particular of sort of free press and assembly and petition. We have a generalized sort of free expression guarantee or provision that protects all of those things, press, assembly, petition, and speech, and does so, as we now know, over time for a variety of different justifications, right? Well, why do we have a free speech guarantee, just to focus on that particular clause, to facilitate, the Supreme Court has said, debate in so-called marketplaces of ideas, sort of a pursuit of truth, rationale, to facilitate self-government, so to understand political issues, but more generally issues of public concern, and as a sort of individual liberty, a provision that protects what you might call self-fulfillment or self-actualization. Speech for its own sake is valuable.
Do you want to add at all to that, Molly?
I would just add that I think our particular concept of freedom of speech is expansive in a way that many other democracies do not have the same level of protections that we offer. And that is something, if you look at Europe, there are often limitations on different types of speech that we don't have here. And it does go to sort of this fundamental place of what does it mean to be an American who has the ability to fully express themselves and all of these expressions of who we are, what we want, our questions, that they need to be totally unfettered in a much more open-ended way than is the case. And there are limitations, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but they're much more narrowly tailored than what we see in many other countries.
Well, why don't you just talk about those limitations while you're on the subject, Molly?
Sure. I mean, I can kick this off. So we, over time, the court has clarified that there are appropriate limitations, such as time, place, and manner restrictions, to allow for speech to occur, but to occur in a way that doesn't put people at physical risk, put people at risk of harm. There also are limitations in terms of some of the nature of what people are allowed to say in certain circumstances. But those are very, again, very narrow. And for the most part, there's actually a real clarity about the idea that your speech cannot be the source of retaliation against you from the government. It can't be the source of negative outcomes against your ability to pursue your employment, to pursue your happiness. And so some of what we're seeing today is a real incursion in ways, and even just rhetorically, an incursion into many areas that we have not seen the court ever articulate before.
Tim, pick up on that. What kind of infringements are we experiencing right now that have not been part of the American political landscape before?
Well, it's hard to say they've not been part of the American political landscape because we've had periods of speech suppression in our history, right? We've even had periods where you could go to jail for criticizing the government.
Oh, let's talk about those for a minute. And then we'll
sure. Yeah. So in 1798, Congress enacted a Sedition Act, which essentially provided that if you criticized the government or its institutions, the federal government, that was a criminal offense. And John Adams, when he was president, invoked that, used it to jail a number of his political enemies, his political critics. The Supreme Court didn't denounce that act until 1964, right? Its precedents seem to suggest, you know, obviously you can't jail someone for criticizing the government, but didn't ground a saying that was contrary to the First Amendment until 1964 in New York Times versus Sullivan. So from a very early period, right, the First Amendment we know today would be unrecognizable, I think, it's fair to say, to the founding generation and to generations subsequent to that one. You know, we've had episodes of jailing people for anti-war dissent, for suspected membership in communist organizations, and for, you know, all manner of speech that today, as Molly said, would be clearly protected by the First Amendment. Much more robust protection today than we had in those previous eras. So in terms of sort of current challenges.
Okay, well, no, wait, hold on. Yeah. Hold that thought for a second, because, you know, I happen to know that the ACLU was founded in 1920, the same year that the League of Women Voters was founded. So, Molly, you've probably defended some of these incursions on the free speech in the history of your institution. Why don't you just embellish on the history thing? Like, where have we strayed from our ideals in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point that this is in the post-Civil War era, right? We see a really different framing of what free speech is going to mean. The ACLU was formed in 1920, and the initial cases were actually about protecting the rights of conscientious objectors and people who were anti-war protesters, which at the time was very unpopular. And then free speech became a major pillar of the work that the ACLU did throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, both on those issues and also, as was mentioned, really protecting the rights of communists, of people who were accused of being communist, other types of speech that were disfavored at different particular points in our political life at that time.
So this isn't 100% new.
No, it's not. I think to see the way that this administration and the president in particular has used threats against free speech specifically, I think is certainly something in the modern era that we have not seen. And again, I think when I hear you share that there are people who are feeling more personally concerned about speaking up or speaking out, for me, it goes to this question of like what people feel is acceptable to be threatened or to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And it had been a long time since we've heard that certainly at the level of the presidency.
Yeah. All right. Now, Tim, back to you. You did some kind of a survey of these things. Tell us about your work in that area and then tell us about what you're finding.
Yeah, I'm calling it a repository. So, you know, for better or worse, I started this project of trying to track the flooded zone with respect to sort of Trump administration First Amendment related challenges or conflicts, let's say. So all the executive orders that relate to First Amendment, all the litigation that those have spawned, executive orders, presidential memoranda, so-called fact sheets, and agency actions enforcing them have spawned, I think it's now up to almost 60 lawsuits just about First Amendment issues, never mind all the rest, which are also significant. And then I collect a commentary, sort of, you know, what have people been saying about the speech challenges of this particular period? Some of those commentaries are about the history that we're talking about. How is this era different, if it is, from those prior speech conflict eras? And it's been a real challenge to keep up, right? I have to say, so I've taken this project on, and now I'm sort of committed to it. And it takes up a few hours a week, at least. And I'm capturing what I'm reading and what some people might send me. And it just runs the gamut. Just to name a few of the things in my repository, some of the major categories, the attacks on law firms and lawyers and the bar, the arrest, detention, and deportation of international students for having the audacity to organize campus protests or participate in them, or in one case, even just write an op-ed in a university newspaper. The sustained attacks on universities, you know, that's multi-pronged, right? So Harvard gets a lot of attention, but of course, the administration has gone after scores of universities under the pretext of not doing enough to deal with anti-Semitism on campus, which is an issue. But I say pretext because the administration has never actually presented evidence, never followed any procedure as it proceeds to terminate funding now into the billions of dollars for Harvard, Columbia, Brown, lots of other elite institutions, right? So using the sort of threat of termination or actual termination of funding to essentially change the campus culture, to sort of retaliate against Harvard and others for their viewpoints, right? And that becomes clear if you listen to just the president's words and those around him. But whether or not you take those into account, there seems to be no other explanation other than a sort of reaction against disfavored speech for what the administration's been doing to universities. A lot of public employees have lost their jobs in retaliation for speech, right? So you have a lot of public employees who are suing. There's a new lawsuit just yesterday, I think it was, by FBI agents or former FBI agents suing on that ground. There has been a massive intervention. This gets much less press into scientific research. Some of that is about defunding scientific research, but other parts of it are about sending prosecutorial letters to publications, well-known publications that publish scientific research. Of course, laying off thousands of scientists and intervening even in sort of what you might consider sort of small ways. So there's one lawsuit involving a couple of researchers whose papers were pulled from a governmental website because they used forbidden terms with respect to gender and race. So it is everything from big picture to even right down into the sort of nitty gritty of, you know, what scientists are able to present or publish on websites. And I'm sure I'm leaving things out because I think I have about 10 or 12 different categories of activity. I haven't said anything about sort of the effort to change, alter, or control the narrative at museums, to defund libraries, to defund public broadcasting. And in one case, with respect to schools operated by the Department of Defense, to remove books. So that issue has come up as a result of the president's executive orders. And I should just say a lot of the litigation that has occurred relates to two or three executive orders that purport to prohibit DEI without ever defining what it is, and gender ideology, which is defined, but really amounts to, in many contexts, an effort to terminate funding based on the viewpoint of the contractor or the fund recipient with respect to gender. So that's just a sort of overview. It's all on First Amendment Watch, its website. If people want to take a look at it, you can sort of do your own digging and looking.
I want to let Molly weigh in on that question, but I have to take a station break first. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today, constitutional crisis, the penalties of free speech. Our guests this afternoon are Timothy Zick, the Robert and Elizabeth Scott Research Professor, and John Marshall Professor of Government and Citizenship at William and Mary Law School, and also Molly Curran-Rolls, the Executive Director at ACLU Maine. The question to Timothy was, what kinds of infringements are we experiencing right now? And he had a pretty long list, Molly.
Quite a laundry list. And thank you so much, Professor, for maintaining this list, despite the incredible amount of time it's taking. I think from that overview, you get a sense of the breadth and scope of what we're seeing. To that list, I would just argue that there are speech-related agreements that are being presented to a number of different application, individual nonprofits and entities that are applying for grants from the federal government. And they're being told that you need to comply with this speech-related agreement in order to be eligible for a grant. Those are also things that we're involved in. The ACLU is involved, both the Maine affiliate and also at the national level, in many of the different incidents of litigation that that professors referenced. And we're also looking really closely and active in litigating some of these riders, essentially, on grant funding. You know, I think from a constitutional perspective, when we talk about why it's so important that the freedom of speech be respected, what we're looking at is participation and the idea that for democracy to be healthy, we need the press, we need individuals, we need scholars to be able to share, as Professor Zick said, their feedback, their thoughts in a totally open-ended way. And so I do think that there's a certain amount of disconnection between the concept that, you know, whatever the issue is that you're going after that you want to address, curtailing the freedom of speech is not the way that, at least in the last 100 years, has been most favored as a way to control it. And in fact, it's really the opposite. So ACLU has historically argued that the speech of those who you might find most odious or whose speech you find most problematic or difficult is the speech that needs to be protected for all of our speech to, in fact, be able to be expressed fully. And I think we keep hearing this administration say, well, there are reasons why, you know, where there are things we're going after. For example, the executive orders that were referenced have these specific goals in mind. But the idea that using this means of shutting down speech and expression as a way to achieve those goals, so far, we're not seeing courts agree. And it really does run very counter to the structure that has been in place.
So when you say we're not seeing courts agree, you mean to say?
So the ACLU and many of our partners have had quite a bit of success in the initial cases that have gone before both trial court and some of the circuits. These will continue to move forward, and litigation takes a long time. But really, right out of the gate, we saw a number of cases, including the Birthright Citizenship case, including the Department of Defense Education case that Professor spoke about, where there were orders to say, you know, just because there's an executive order out there doesn't mean that it's constitutionally appropriate. Some of the other cases, the Mahmoud Khalil case, he's the student from Columbia who was detained even though he's a permanent resident because of his speech. And the Ozturk case, which was the case where a woman who was a Tufts University student had just written an op-ed and then was detained. In both those instances, they were able to be successful through a lot of really dogged advocacy and were released, but after quite a long time. And in the case of Mr. Khalil, he missed the birth of his first child, you know, was detained in Louisiana. I think what we're finding is that at least at this stage, certainly these decisions are being appealed by the administration, and so the litigation continues, but the initial forays have been successful in pushing back.
Can I add to that?
So, no, please.
So a couple of things. One, on the litigation front, the administration is losing very badly in First Amendment cases. Anybody who knows anything about First Amendment doctrine and precedent could ascertain why pretty easily. when you retaliate against a law firm based on the clients that it represented, and you have no other reason, and you put that in the executive order, I don't like these law firms, I'm going to punish them because they represented left-leaning clients. Every court to have addressed a law firm order has resoundingly rejected them on First Amendment grounds. Every court that has been faced with a habeas corpus petition, a sort of bail and release question in the immigration context, has, in part at least on First Amendment grounds, released the international student. Most courts have seen through the government's argument that, well, these executive orders about diversity, equity, and inclusion, they're just government saying what it thinks, right? Setting policy. But no, they have real effects, right? Assuming you can figure out what's even required of you. So most of them are unconstitutionally vague, and the enforcement actions that are behind them suffer from various First Amendment infirmities. So they've been losing very badly. As Molly said, they're going to appeal some of these cases. They've appealed one of the law firm cases so far. I don't know what their argument's going to be, First Amendment argument. But district courts are resoundingly rejecting the administration's position in these cases. And some of the cases, you know, the administration has been pressed, for example, in the student cases to say, well, what is the non-speech basis on which you arrested and detained this person? And they don't have anything to say. They suggest they have other things, but they never actually tell a court why, other than the speech of the student, they were detained, in many cases moved from the East Coast to Louisiana. Their lawyers trying to chase them down and track them down. So it's a really unimpressive record for the administration, at least so far. The one thing I left off my list of things, and I do want to add it to the list, is freedom of the press. That was a common sort of theme in Trump 1.0 in his first term. Most of it was sort of rhetorical attacks on the press, you know, calling them the enemy of the people. That's now been translated in the second presidential term for Trump into various actions. He's excluded the Associated Press from White House events because they refused to bend the knee on Gulf of America. He's excluded the Wall Street Journal because of their reporting on Jeffrey Epstein in the same fashion. The agencies in the Trump administration, the FCC and others, have gone after broadcast stations in administrative proceedings, essentially because of their editorial decisions. So 60 Minutes and CBS, the statement by George Stephanopoulos on ABC, which they claim was defamatory. And these media outlets have been caving in and capitulating and settling with the Trump administration. And I'll add just one other thing. While this is all going on, the president of the United States is a plaintiff in a number of defamation lawsuits. So there's sort of a leveraging of power that he has as president, you know, to sue for defamation. And some of those cases, even though they lack merit, have been settled.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you both about has to do with chilled speech, because when I talk about people who've been afraid to come on, I mean, I feel like that's in the chilled speech vein. And it's mainly because they are in nonprofit organizations that get federal funding that serve a particular vulnerable constituency. And they're afraid if they speak out about the policies of the administration, their funding will be further cut in retribution, and their vulnerable constituencies will be further harmed. Molly, could you give us a little primer on chilled speech and where chilled speech doctrine comes from and how that's playing into this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, the concept here is that when you see these kinds of actions taken against individuals, you're not going to feel comfortable coming forward and either continuing the work that you do or moving into another area of work. One of the challenges inherent in this is that there is this overbreadth. There's a lack of clarity about exactly what is prohibited, which makes people then think, well, I'm not going to do anything because I don't know what I'm able to actually do. I don't know how to navigate this. And I think the other real challenge that we see is that there's this sort of everything everywhere all at once, right? This is, you don't know where the focus is going to be. Will it be on me as an individual? Might it be on my entity, my organization, or my department if I'm in a university? Or might it be the entire university, right? So it's been a really important piece of our entire cultural mindset that people can express themselves and not have to worry about what's going to happen in this way. So for the first time, I think, especially for people who, for example, do public service of different kinds, this idea that there might be a political implication to sharing what your experiences have been or what your research methods have allowed you to identify as a major issue, this is really crossing a line that chills almost every aspect of your self-expression with regard to the work that you're doing.
You want to add to that? Chilled speech.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The vagueness is a particular problem because if you don't know where the line is, you're going to self-censor, right, to avoid the consequences. And the consequences here, let's be clear about what they are. The President of the United States himself has targeted people for retaliation, right? Celebrities, current public officials. There doesn't seem to be any real dividing line as to who he might go after, right? Academics probably will be on that list at some point if they aren't already. Universities stand to lose, as I said, billions of dollars in funding if they don't do whatever the administration thinks they ought to do. And again, they're not making that entirely clear about protests on campus or diversity, equity, inclusion, or gender. And there's this whole climate of fear that has just sort of grown up around all of these different executive orders and agency actions. And it just seeps into everything, right? So corporations are backing away from supporting a diverse workforce. I don't want to use the word diverse. Even that word may catch the attention of somebody in Washington and I'd be in trouble. There have been lawyers who've advised presenters at hospitals not to use that word diverse to describe patient populations. It has nothing to do with race or gender or transgender, but that's the extent of it, right? It is so deeply ingrained now, this fear of retribution, that it's affecting, you know, boardrooms and classrooms and research entities and all the rest.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Molly Curran-Rawls, Executive Director, ACLU Maine, and Timothy Zick, the Robert and Elizabeth Scott Research Professor and John Marshall Professor of Government and Citizenship at William & Mary Law School. Our topic today is Constitutional Crisis, the Penalties of Free Speech. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is a particularly fraught moment as we're taping this show today because it's right after the political assassination of Charlie Kirk and the apprehension of his killer. But do either of you see a slight irony in the way that hate speech is maybe proliferating and certain other kinds of speech is being clamped down?
I think, as I said earlier, the ACLU is pretty well known for working to protect speech of all kinds, even speech that I might not like or that you might not like. And it is important, I think, to recognize that both, you know, the rule of law in general and also this particular set of rights that we have in the Bill of Rights, in many instances are designed to, and all of politics really, is designed to move us away from violence and give us alternative ways to meet one another on the playing field of ideas and to share them and to sometimes profoundly disagree with one another, but to do so with a level of respectfulness for the process and for the ability of each person to fully express and be themselves. And so I think all of the threats and certainly violence are contributing to a climate in which there isn't that level of safety in the way that there needs to be for a democracy to be healthy and for our country to function the way that it's designed to function.
You want to comment?
Yeah, I think it's hard to find clean hands in these debates sometimes, right? So the President of the United States blames left rhetoric, political rhetoric for Charlie Kirk's murder. The president engages in more violent rhetoric, imagery, and memes than any president in the history of the United States, right? I think it's fair to say. I'm willing to go out on that limb. And it's responsible. There have been studies showing that his anti-Islamic speech has led to actual assaults of Islamic people in the United States. So hypocrisy doesn't even begin to cover or label, you know, that move, right, to say that, well, we have a problem of left political rhetoric and you need to tone that down. He's not the right messenger for that. Murdering someone for their views is obviously abhorrent, right? On the other hand, you know, Turning Point USA targeted professors for their views, and people involved with that organization harassed online and sometimes physically members of the academic community for the views that they espoused, and only for the views that they espoused. On the left, you know, you have people who claim that certain speech is itself violence. Violence is violence. Speech isn't violence, right? And there is plenty of rhetoric on the left that one could characterize as violent. So as I said, nobody seems to have sort of clean hands. You support the speech you support, and you sort of want to suppress the speech that you don't like, and that's not how it works.
Yeah,
that's not supporting the First Amendment and free inquiry. You know, no matter what people say about their commitment to it, it's hard to find someone that truly is committed to that principle.
Well, maybe the ACLU. Yeah.
Yes, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just share, you know, we do a lot of work with libraries around Banned Books Week. And there have been, there's almost like a shorthand that we use to talk about censorship and to talk about speech in something like Banned Books Week either appeals to you or doesn't, maybe like on a really knee-jerk basis at this point politically. And when I've talked to librarians, they say, you know, many more people these days will come up and say, oh, I saw this book on your banned books list, or I see it on your display. I want to know more about this so that I can make sure my kid doesn't access this book, or so I make sure that this idea isn't promulgated. And I think this sense of fear of ideas, fear of speech is has also permeated both the left and the right in recent years. And it is really critical that people who care about this issue take the time to unpack how hard it is to hold that space and how hard it is not to jump to, well, I want to stop this speech because I don't like it right now, but instead to say there's actually something bigger that we're responsible for that involves our civic communal values and involves our legal structure that we're at risk of rupturing if we go down this road too far.
I mean, we've talked a little bit about, what did you call it before, the time, place, and circumstance carve-outs? Yeah, is that what you said? Tell people what that is exactly and what kind of speech would be carved out under
those. A good example would be a protest, for example, if someone wanted to hold a rally or a march, that a city could say, you're allowed to do that, but there will be certain time, place, and manner restrictions. There'll be a certain time that you're able to do it, a certain location in the city, and the way that it'll be structured so that it will be safe. Those restrictions have to be narrowly tailored to the interests of the city. So there have been cases where the, you know, cities have suggested, why don't you move your rally or move your parade to an unused, in one case it involved New York City, it was like, go to an island, right? Go very far away from the place that you're trying to affect and make this argument to a cornfield or make this argument to an empty space. That was deemed not an appropriate restriction of time or place or manner. But in many other instances, you know, it is okay for cities to ask people to comply with different limitations. But also people can still assemble and people can still express themselves in many different settings, for example, without permits, and you know, do have to navigate this area, but can do so with a lot of freedom and again without retaliation against them personally or against their standing as a citizen in this from the perspective of the city government or the local government.
And where would incitement things fall into this? I don't know if it's a carve-out, but you educate me about where that falls.
Yeah, that's a type of speech that's disfavored, right? So if you are making statements that are specifically inciting, which again, there's a lot of case law about what exactly that entails, and then there can be limitations. The famous example is, you know, shouting fire in a crowded auditorium. But you know, the ability to get people excited about an issue or to galvanize energy around it is not limited. I mean, certainly you can make emotional appeals, but yeah, you can't advocate unlawful action, violence, for example, immediately to occur.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say this is another area where there's a lot of contested facts. The January 6th, the run up to the January 6th and then the aftermath of the January 6th attack, there were statements made by President Trump that many felt were inciting and that others disagreed about. So, you know, we're part of what's so complex right now is people really are seeing the same information from diametrically opposed positions.
Yeah. Timothy, I think that you've made a case that the moment we're in has little precedent in American culture.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, as I said, we've certainly had speech suppressive eras. We've had eras in which people were jailed for their political speech. You might say, well, that hasn't happened recently. I would say it has. International students have been sent to detention, jail, for their political speech. One of the most exceptional things about this era is that the threats to free speech are coming from the president, from the executive. Congress is not involved, right? In some cases, the president has just stepped right over a supine Congress and withheld funding or done whatever he pleases without any congressional authorization for him to sort of enforce the law. So that itself is exceptional. The closest thing to that would be Richard Nixon, who very much wanted the IRS and other agencies to help him go after his political enemies. Well, guess what? They said no. And he eventually got caught up in Watergate and he resigned. So Nixon wanted that to happen. Trump has made that happen. That is the important takeaway, I think, historically. This is the most fraught free speech environment we've been in since the McCarthy era, where government was hunting down supposed communists and erasing them from the federal workforce and going after their private livelihoods and all that. This is a very broad campaign to control what people say about a number of different subjects. And more than that, to punish people that the administration disagrees with. That is exceptional. It's extraordinary. We should recognize that. And part of the reason I wanted to put the repository together, which, by the way, is a Word document, is now approaching 100 pages in 8 months or 9 months of the second presidential term of Donald Trump, was to sort of keep a contemporaneous record. Imagine if you're in the McCarthy era and someone was actually paying attention to all this stuff that's happening. It's such a flooded zone, it's hard to organize it. So that was part of the reason, you know, for my own purposes, but also to sort of help other people who might want to make sense of it. And I had people at the beginning say, well, this isn't so different from, you know, Joe Biden or Barack Obama or George Bush. And I just say this, I could not imagine 100 pages of material coming out of, you know, the entire 8 years Obama was president, not even close. This president is pushing First Amendment boundaries like no other president, and certainly in the modern era, has done. And there is a serious threat here. Sometimes it's hard to stay focused on it because of all the other things that are going on, but it's there.
Yeah. What can we do to help? I mean, I want to spend what time we have left together talking about that. I know, you know, some brave litigators and law organizations like ACLU and others have been taking every opportunity to defend people in courts. But what can those of us who aren't lawyers do to be supportive of a pushback on what's happening? Would you say, Molly?
I think paying attention, not allowing yourself to get overwhelmed, which is not an easy thing to do, but it's really critical. And I think educating yourself again about, you know, what does free speech mean to me? Why do I think this is important? And when am I seeing something that I'm being told is not a free speech threat, but that actually might be, in fact? How can I analyze that from a critical perspective? The other thing I think, you know, it has been really difficult to see different law firms, some university entities, you know, just capitulate. As the professor said, you know, even though there might have been very strong legal arguments, this has also happened with some of the production studios, some of the media entities too. And when that happens, it normalizes this. It makes it a lot easier for there to be a sense that it's, you know, these settlements are based in something. So I think there is incredible value to standing up and making sure that your rights are vindicated and trying to understand as much as you're able to navigate what you're seeing so that you can advocate with your congressional delegation about the importance of Congress getting involved, with your local legislators to, you know, better understand these issues, and with everybody from school boards to you know, folks who are in positions of power at different companies. I know there have been allegedly a lot of firings just in the last 2 days based on people's social media posts related to the recent violence. And, you know, these are examples where...
Wait a minute. Say that what you said.
There's some coverage of, and this is circulating wildly online, I don't have any specifics, but there's a lot of buzz about the idea that a number of people have been laid off or have, you know, been fired because of different types of social media comments that they made or information that they shared related to the violence this week.
I see.
And so that's an example of a, you know, a place where this might be happening in your own community, and helping people sort of step back from the brink to say, well, wait, what do we care about here? What are we preserving here? And to what extent can we build an appreciation for these fundamental rights of expression as we seek to try to respond to what's happening?
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Molly Curran-Rolls, Executive Director, ACLU Maine, and Timothy Zick, Robert and Elizabeth Scott Research Professor and John Marshall Professor of Government and Citizenship at William & Mary Law School. This program was pre-recorded on September 12th. No listener calls are being taken. We've been talking all afternoon about free speech and the penalties on free speech and the free speech suppression that we're living under in the current administration. And we've turned in this last quarter to talking about what we can do to push back, stand up, and support those who are being targeted. And so, Timothy, it's your turn to weigh in on that.
Yeah, I agree with everything Molly said. I mean, the capitulation by targeted entities is a real problem. That includes not just universities, but broadcast media, who are bending over backwards, right? Even sort of surrendering their editorial discretion rights under the First Amendment to either, you know, get mergers approved or just to stay out of the crosshairs of an administration that is vindictive and vengeful. I do think it's important to litigate these cases, right? I want to downplay what lawyers are doing. It's absolutely essential. But one of the lessons I've drawn from this era so far is that that's not going to be enough. The lawsuits, the courts, to the extent they play a role, even First Amendment doctrines, which are, you know, speech protective, robustly speech protective, can't solve the problem of chill and capitulation. They can't prevent widespread violations of First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court's made that even harder by saying nationwide injunctions, sort of omnibus relief, generally can't be granted unless you certify a class of individuals, et cetera. So that's going to pose different problems. Even if you're a researcher and your paper can be found online, what about the researcher who didn't sue, who just decided to walk away or didn't even do the research because they're not going to get it funded, right? So all of that, the First Amendment should be on the ballot. It almost never is. It's unfortunate that, you know, Democrats in particular at this point do not talk more about freedom of speech because it is under siege and it's a major issue. Now, it's competing with lots of other different issues. I acknowledge that, but it needs to be on the ballot.
And okay, lastly, so when you say it's on the ballot, so we're a referendum state, and some of our listeners are going to hear a citizen initiative ballot question. That's not really what you mean.
No, I mean in the midterm congressional elections, in the next presidential election, in local elections, frankly, because states are also involved in this repressive regime and campaign. Republican-led states are very much on board with all of this, prohibiting DEI and suppressing speech in classrooms and in other places. So this is not just a federal issue. It's a state issue and a local issue as well. But part of the problem is sort of educating people about, well, what's going on with the First Amendment. And so this program is really valuable, I think, in that way. So we need to do more of that.
What can we do to support the people that are being affected by this as community members or citizens? Like you were saying, Molly, if people we know have lost their jobs because of this, or, I mean, how can we show some solidarity with them, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, part of what's so hard about this is that it does require moving beyond partisan divides in standing up for these principles, again, regardless of whether you agree with the underlying speech. And I think too often we have been defaulting on both the left and the right to just supporting speech when it's speech that we agree with. And so, you know, breaking out of that and championing the speech of people, regardless of the content, is very countercultural right now. But I think it's a part of the way that we could move forward to demonstrate what the value of this is and have the real conversation about what these freedoms mean. Sometimes, in the banned books context, another thing that's come up that we've heard is that people have a sense that we're only interested in certain books being published. So books maybe by people who are part of minority groups or books by people who historically have not been in publishing. That's not the case, right? The concept is not that there are specific favored types of speech, but that there's an openness to everyone being able to share their view. And so we all have a stake in this because this really relates to all of our ability to express our views. Just because there's someone in power who I agree with shouldn't mean that I then have full range of expressive opportunity. And then when that's not the case, I will lose it. That's not how this country works.
Yeah. I know some people drop their Washington Post subscription when they change their editorial policy. Is that kind of stuff effective, do you think, Tim?
I don't know. Probably not. It's something you can do. But unless it's done by, literally hundreds of thousands of people, that kind of boycott might not be very effective. It's hard to say. It's such a deep and wide problem. It's kind of hard to say, well, what can I do? It's you sort of feel powerless in the face of it. And part of the reason I wanted to sort of study it and keep track of it was to sort of for my own awareness to understand the stakes, right? So who's involved here? Whose rights are involved? And, we can't all litigate cases and we can't, pour resources into like universities to help them. So it's a tough thing to know what exactly one can do in the face of this kind of challenge.
Does it help to speak out? I mean, to share the burden in some way?
It either helps or places you in peril, right?
Well,
so you have to decide to have the courage of your convictions. And I've made that decision. I'm an academic. I'm in this to share ideas and distribute, my knowledge and expertise. Maybe my university has a different view of what I'm doing, but thankfully they're not intervening. They're not telling me, what I can and cannot say. I'm in a privileged place, right? So a private employee could be fired for their political speech as an at-will employee. It's possible I could be terminated. I would hope not for things that I say. But part of it is speaking out and refusing to capitulate and bend the knee. And if you support a diverse workforce, you ought to be able to say so. And you know, giving into this retribution campaign and this culture of fear is a real mistake. And, you know, I understand in some contexts, you know, well, I have billions of dollars in research funding. I can't operate my university. I know what the stakes are, but still, right, the principle remains. You have to stand up for freedom of speech and freedom of press.
Do you think Harvard's stand has been effective or not so much?
I mean, they won so
Okay.
far. But, you know, it depends on who you ask, right? So there are people who are concerned about the long-term relationship of Harvard to the federal government and funding. They may win this round, but they may lose the longer war with the Trump administration. The Trump administration won't be, one would hope, in office forever. So, you know, there's a question as to what comes after this. Is this a blueprint for other Republican presidential administrations and keep doing this? So far, I'm impressed that Harvard stepped forward. You know, Brown caved, Columbia caved. They made these deals, these amorphous deals with the administration, and the administration is going to change the terms of those deals, I have no doubt. So it's a very tough decision institutionally, even for a behemoth like Harvard, right? Not to mention universities with far smaller endowments. So in the short term, I think what they've done is praiseworthy, beneficial to their community, and the right thing to do. But, you know, we'll see what happens on appeal in this case, or whether there are reports that Harvard is considering a deal that includes paying this administration $500 million, not to mention whatever else they can put in the agreement. So I think we'll have to wait and see.
Do you think there are any places or circumstances in Maine, Molly, that deserve to be lifted up here and would be worthy of citizen support?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who are bravely pushing back in a variety of ways. Again, whether that's at the hyper-local level and school boards and, you know, and engaging in conversation about the implications of free speech at the in their community, to people who are more public figures who are doing this work. One of the things that we've been talking a little bit about is, you know, bringing a level of creativity to this too, and thinking about the ways that resistance can highlight absurdity. It can be humorous. It can be artistic. It can take a lot of different forms. And there was a news coverage of, in the early days of the administration, I think in March, they had done a review of a number of websites, including Department of Defense websites, to try to pull down material that they didn't like. And they took down all the material about the Enola Gay, which, of course, was the World War II Medal of Honor recipient aircraft that dropped the atomic bomb. You know, there is some of this that runs so counter to common sense that it's absurd, right? It's funny. And so to continue to think about ways that we can highlight examples that help us feel more engaged with what's happening, and also that we're not afraid to say, wait, this doesn't make any sense. And no matter your political position or your political take on different issues, this is not the way that this is done here. This is not acceptable. I think we need to continue to create a sense of that being a normal thing to put out into the community. And there are folks all across Maine who I know are dedicated to that.
Anybody you want to name for our listeners to be in touch with or support?
Well, you know, I think one of the people that I follow, and I know a lot of people who listen to this will be following as well, is Heather Cox Richardson,
yeah.
Who, like the ACLU has said, I'm taking a nonpartisan approach. I'm a historian. I'm going to talk about this in a framework of history and information sharing. I think the incredible reception she's found is related to the fact that she really is just providing very clear-eyed, detailed information on an ongoing basis. And that takes a great deal of courage, I think, right now.
Yeah. Well, we're about running out of time, and I promised to give you each a couple of minutes to summarize this giant topic. So I want to let you each gather your thoughts and share those parting thoughts with our listeners. Do you want to go first, Molly?
Sure. I would say, you know, weaponizing the law to go after speech is an abuse of power. And it is not American. It is not the way our system is supposed to function at this point. And so the kind of draconian activities that we're seeing really require that people learn more about the freedom of speech, grapple with the parts of it that are challenging, but develop a stronger sense of connection to it, both as individuals and also on a broader political basis, because these are rights that once taken from us can be very, very difficult to get back. We know from history and from the 20th century that this is not, we're playing with fire here. And so I think the more involved that people can remain, in spite of the fact that it's hard, the better. And we have a lot of information at ACLU.org. There are lots of there's lots of Maine-based information at ACLMaine.org. And I know League of Women Voters shares information too on a regular basis. It's really painful to see the kind of curtailment that we're seeing, and we have to continue to push back.
Thank you, Molly. Go ahead, Tim. Parting thoughts?
Yeah, I think the conversation just highlights that we're living through this exceptional and unprecedented era of threats to free speech and free press. And, you know, we've long had a commitment to what the court describes as uninhibited, robust, and wide open public discourse. And that has been a pillar of self-government in the United States for decades now. And we are in danger, I think real danger, of losing that. I would ask people who are listening who are Republicans or you know, independents, whether they would be comfortable with a Democratic president doing essentially the same thing, attacking institutions they care about, trying to control narratives with respect to history, trying to control scientific inquiry. The reason we, you know, protect the freedom of speech that we hate is because power changes hands, right? I would not want to give someone this kind of power if I cared about my own set of issues, right? And so I think people should think about that. And one last thought is that there's often this confusion between social ostracism and opprobrium, so-called cancel culture and those sorts of things, and people's reaction to that. And the government of the United States, or the government of a state, imposing orthodoxies on universities, law firms, researchers, and all the rest, those are two entirely distinct things. The First Amendment speaks to one of those, the governmental action, and not the other. So I think we should be much clearer about that in our conversations about who's controlling speech and for what reasons.
Thank you both so much. That is our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Molly Curran-Rolls, Executive Director, ACLU Maine, and Timothy Zick, the Robert and Elizabeth Scott Research Professor and John Marshall Professor of Government and Citizenship at William and Mary Law School. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic, including links to some of the references that our guests mentioned. And you can subscribe to our podcast there also, lwvme.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next month.